Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Breast Cancer Treatment Update. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it's because of that collaboration that we have reached so many of you. We have on the call today over 1,008 people. So you're a lot of you on this call, and you're from all over the United States. You're from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. We also today have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, India, Ireland, Italy, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about our speakers and what they're going to cover. There also is information about all of the collaborating organizations as resources for each of you to call upon after today's program. There also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you each to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, you are the best people to tell us what we should be doing, so that we really welcome your recommendations for topics and for suggestions of programs that you'd like to see us offer. Indeed, today's program is based on feedback from your evaluation. So you're the best people to tell us what to do. So we very much rely on your feedback and evaluations. Now, today's program is made possible by an educational grant from Sanofi Aventis, US LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Eric Weiner. Dr. Weiner is Director, Breast Oncology Center. He is Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Chief Scientific Advisor, Susan G. Komen for the Cure. So you can see Dr. Weiner wears many hats, and he is going to start with an overview of breast cancer and discuss current standard of care, and also understanding triple-negative breast cancer. I now turn this program over to Dr. Weiner.
Hi. Well, thanks, Carolyn, for having me. I think one of the hats that I wear that perhaps you didn't mention, although maybe people assumed it, is that I'm a breast cancer doctor, and I spend a day and a half a week taking care of patients with breast cancer and have done so for the last 20 years. My job in the next 10 minutes is to provide an overview of breast cancer, to talk about some standards of care, and to focus on triple-negative breast cancer. So first, in terms of the overview, I think everyone knows that there are approximately 180,000 cases of breast cancer in the U.S. each year. The number goes up and down a little bit each year. It varies by a small amount, but that is the general figure that we use. A somewhat smaller number than was the case 5 and 8 years ago, when more women were taking hormone replacement therapy, and the abrupt discontinuation of hormone replacement therapy seems to have led to a decline in the number of cases per year. In addition to those 180,000 cases of invasive breast cancer, there are about 60,000 cases of ductal carcinoma in the U.S. each year. And the vast majority of those cases are identified through screening mammography. I think, as people probably know, ductal carcinoma is in and of itself entirely ductal carcinoma in situ, that is, DCIS, is in and of itself non-life-threatening, but is important in the sense that in some number of women, if left untreated, DCIS or ductal carcinoma in situ could evolve to an invasive breast cancer. When we think about breast cancer, we think about breast cancer in really two different ways. One, we think about the stage of the cancer, which is really a reflection of how much cancer there is. And then separately, we think about the biologic features of the cancer, or what I sometimes call the personality of the cancer. In terms of the stage, women who have stage 1 breast cancer have small tumors and no lymph node involvement. Women who have stage 2 breast cancer have either bigger tumors or some amount of lymph node involvement, and women who have stage 3 breast cancer tend to have either larger tumors or much more extensive lymph node involvement. And here we're talking about lymph node involvement both under the arm and in some women with the most advanced lymph node involvement, potentially lymph node involvement above the clavicle as well. And for women who have stage 1, stage 2, or stage 3 breast cancer, when we begin a treatment program, the goal of that program is to cure the patient, to hope that the cancer will never show its face again, and to devise a treatment plan that maximizes that likelihood. For women who have stage 4 breast cancer, which is where the cancer has spread beyond the breast and beyond the regional lymph nodes, to places like the bones, the liver, the lungs, we are not, at least in 2010, able, in the vast, vast majority of patients, to be able to entirely eradicate the cancer and to hope that we can achieve a cure. On the other hand, more and more women who have stage 4 breast cancer can live with that cancer for many, many years. And while that's not true for all women, it is true for an increasing proportion of women who have stage 4 breast cancer. And I think any medical oncologist in the country will tell you that a large portion of their practice is taken up with the care of women who have stage 4 breast cancer because, again, thankfully, they do well and they often live with the cancer for a very long time. That's certainly true for women who have estrogen receptor positive stage 4 breast cancer, and it's increasingly true for women who have HER2 positive stage 4 breast cancer. Now, beyond thinking about the stage of the cancer, we think about the personality of the cancer. And when I say that, what I'm referring to is whether the cancer is sensitive to hormones or not, so whether it's estrogen receptor positive or estrogen receptor negative, and then whether it is so-called HER2 positive or HER2 negative. And as many of you know, HER2 is a protein that results from a gene being present in excess quantity. And if a patient has a tumor that is so-called HER2 positive, that tumor is much more likely to be responsive to drugs like trastuzumab, commonly called Herceptin, or lapatinib, which is also called Tykerb. And what has changed so much over the past decade for women with HER2-positive breast cancer is that we have these new and very specific treatments for that subtype of cancer, and those are treatments that specifically target HER2. When we think about standards of treatment for women who have stage 1, stage 2, or stage 3 breast cancer, our treatment usually involves a combination of different types of approaches. So we generally use surgery, either an excision or, in some cases, a mastectomy, oftentimes with radiation. For women who have an excision alone or a lumpectomy, radiation is virtually always given. For women who have a mastectomy, radiation is less frequently given, although still there are a fair number of women who have a mastectomy and may still need to have radiation. And then some type of medical or systemic therapy is generally given to help prevent a recurrence of the cancer. Chemotherapy, which is often given to help prevent a recurrence of cancer, is actually given less today than it was 10 years ago because increasingly we understand the women who are most likely to benefit from chemotherapy and those who may be less likely to benefit. For women who have triple negative breast cancer or HER2 positive breast cancer, and I'm going to talk in a minute a little more about triple negative breast cancer, chemotherapy is almost always part of the post-surgery treatment or the adjuvant treatment. For women who have HER2 positive breast cancer, in addition to the chemotherapy, we often use the drug Herceptin. But for women who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer that is HER2 negative, and this is about 70% of all women with breast cancer in the United States. So again, the cancer is sensitive to hormones and drugs like Herceptin can't be used because it's HER2 negative. There, we've seen a decline in the use of chemotherapy, and it's not by any means that chemotherapy has been eliminated entirely from the treatment of those women. But for many of those women, hormonal therapy alone appears to be adequate treatment, and the addition of chemotherapy in that setting is often far less beneficial than in women who have triple negative or HER2 positive breast cancer. So increasingly, it's becoming a smaller subset of women who have estrogen receptor positive and HER2 negative breast cancer who are receiving chemotherapy. And that is something that is likely to continue to evolve over the years ahead as we have more information and as we have better and better predictors of which women benefit from most from chemotherapy, which women benefit from most from hormonal therapy, and hopefully as well as we identify new treatments that can augment the standard therapies. I promised in the last few minutes that I would talk about triple-negative breast cancer, and let me just move to that topic right now. So triple-negative breast cancer accounts for about only 10 to 15% of all breast cancer diagnosed in the United States each year. It is estrogen and progesterone receptor negative, so hormonal therapy cannot be given, and it is also HER2 negative, so treatments like Herceptin cannot be given. More and more is thought of as a subtype of breast cancer that is particularly worrisome. But I actually want to reassure people that by no means is triple negative breast cancer something that one should be terrified of or something that, as some patients will say, is indicative of a death sentence or anything like that. Yes, triple negative breast cancer can't be treated with hormonal therapy and with Herceptin, but it tends to be very sensitive to chemotherapy. And the treatment we use for women who have triple negative breast cancer usually involves a combination of surgery and then chemotherapy, sometimes with radiation used as well, as I was describing before. There are some important differences between triple negative breast cancer and the other subtypes of breast cancer. One is that if, in fact, triple negative breast cancer comes back, it is more likely to come back or recur earlier rather than later. Unlike women who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, where recurrences can happen over the course of 10 or 15 or even 20 years, women who have triple negative breast cancer, if they are going to have a recurrence, usually have that recurrence within the first several years after their diagnosis. Triple negative breast cancer also appears to be much more common in women who have a specific type of inherited breast cancer, that is women who have BRCA1 mutations. And triple negative breast cancer seems to be more common in young African-American women, possibly in Hispanic women. And there has been some talk, although we're really short on good data, that triple negative breast cancer may be more common in some developing countries. There are some new and very exciting treatments for triple negative breast cancer that are really on the horizon and some that may be close to coming to clinic. One of those treatments is a treatment called a PARP inhibitor, and this is a drug that takes care of a specific abnormality or addresses a specific abnormality within the triple-negative breast cancer cell. Triple-negative breast cancer cells are thought to have problems repairing their own DNA or their own genome, and the PARP inhibitors work by interfering with DNA repair as well. So essentially, they are taking advantage of a weakness that already exists in the triple-negative breast cancer cell. And there are several different PARP inhibitors that are in clinical trials as we speak. Some of those trials have been completed, and we're waiting for results. And I think we all think that it's quite likely that one or more of those drugs will be available commercially within the next 12 to 24 months. Triple-negative breast cancer is also an area where there is an extensive amount of research going on at the moment, research that crosses from clinical research to laboratory research, and I think it's very likely that we're going to have a whole host of new drugs that will be available for women with triple-negative breast cancer in the years ahead. And again, I just want to emphasize that for most women who have early-stage triple-negative breast cancer, so stage 1 and stage 2 and even stage 3 triple-negative breast cancer, that our hope is that with the currently available treatments that we can proceed with treatment and leave a woman with as low a chance as possible of having a recurrence of her cancer. So with that, let me turn it back over to Carolyn, who will move on to the other speakers. I'm happy to address any questions that come up after the other speakers have a chance to talk.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Weiner, for just a really outstanding presentation, really setting the stage for this and really really very informative. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Edith Perez. Dr. Perez is professor of medicine, Mayo Clinic. She's director, Cancer Clinical Study Unit and Breast Cancer Program, Division of Hematology and Oncology. She's chair of the Breast Cancer Committee, North Central Cancer Treatment Group. She also wears many hats. And Dr. Perez is going to address new treatment approaches and clinical trials. I now turn the program over to Dr. Perez.
Thank you very much, Caroline. It is truly my pleasure to be part of this one-hour teleconference today. I'm specifically very happy that there are so many attendees from all over the world. And also the fact that, you know, after this thorough review by Dr. Weiner related to essentially state-of-the-art management of patients with breast cancer, we can quickly or briefly address new treatment approaches and specifically mention some of the ongoing clinical trials that we and others are involved in with the ultimate goal that we all have, which is to bridge or establish a collaboration between new science and the lives of patients. You know, the way I view new treatment approaches and clinical trials is that we are all trying to find solutions to the problem of breast cancer. There has been an identification that breast cancer remains a major problem, not only in the U.S., worldwide. As you heard from Dr. Weiner, significant advances have actually been made over the last several years to better categorize different subtypes of breast cancer, attempts to use the treatments that are currently available in the best optimal patient situations. But in spite of the advances, there's still a lot of work that remains to be done. And the work needs to be conducted in the context of patients collaborating with physicians and scientists so that we can better explore the biology of breast cancer. In other words, what makes cancers appear? What makes cancers respond to some treatments and not others? How can we determine the patients who are most likely to benefit from one treatment versus another? How can we best determine the likelihood that some patients may or may not have of developing side effects from the older treatments as well as the newer treatments? Added to all of these issues is that we need to take into consideration as we develop clinical trial of some very important patient-related issues, because for some patients it is fairly straightforward to be able to come to the clinic on a weekly basis, but for some other patients, participation in trials may be hampered if they don't have ability to come to the clinic on a regular basis, or in other words, they have some transportation challenges that we need to help the patients with. But overall, our goal is let's understand the science of the biology of breast cancer better, and let's come up with some clinical trial strategies to help us improve the outcome of our patients. So the way we're doing this is, if I can provide some very succinct examples, is that we're looking at trials evaluating new chemotherapy drugs. We have trials evaluating what we call newer targeted treatments for breast cancer. But we also have trials that help us optimize the delivery of different treatments to patients. In other words, you know, let's say we have an agent such as chemotherapy that may work in 50% of patients. Well, one of the strategies that we and others are exploring is whether we can have patients receive more of the chemotherapy into the tumor cells instead of the chemotherapy affecting other parts of the body so that we can optimize the effectiveness of the chemotherapy while minimizing side effects. Another very important area being looked at in the context of clinical trials is the area of what we call molecular predictors of response. And I alluded to this a few moments ago, but in general, what we're trying to do is evaluate tumor specimens and then test for the presence or absence of certain proteins and genes that may help us predict the likelihood that a patient may benefit from one treatment versus another. Now that I've addressed this in fairly general terms, let me just, in the next few minutes, cover three specific areas that actually were alluded to by Dr. Weiner a few moments ago. Let's first take the patients who are diagnosed with what we call estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Well, we know that we have several agents that work in that situation, such as tamoxifen, the aromatase inhibitor, and some other medications, but the new clinical trials are actually combining these antiestrogens with other targeted drugs, and there are several of them currently under investigation, and actually some of those initial results will be available at the upcoming American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, or ASCO meeting, which is going to be held starting next week in Chicago. In the area of HER2-positive breast cancer, we know that there are agents such as trastuzumab or Herceptin and the other drug, as Eric mentioned, lapatinib or Ticarb. But I tell you, there is a tremendous number of agents very promising to further optimize the targeting of HER2. And some of these drugs are called pertuzumab. There's another drug that is called TDM1. There's another drug that is called neratinib. And essentially, these drugs are being evaluated not only in the setting of advanced or stage 4 breast cancer, but these agents are started to be evaluated in the neoadjuvant setting. In other words, in patients who have just been diagnosed with breast cancer, the tumors may be a little too large for lumpectomies to be possible. So we're starting to look at these novel anti-HER2 treatments to see if by introducing them many times in combination with chemotherapy, we can be more effective in shrinking the tumor so that patients can have a less aggressive surgical procedure. And then we have the major third area in breast cancer, which is the triple negative setting. There is a tremendous amount of excitement in this area, too, in terms of the clinical trials being done. You heard a few minutes ago about the group of agents called the PARP, P-A-R-P inhibitors. And although none of them have been yet approved by the FDA, the data that are being generated in the clinical trials with these agents is of such interest that I completely concur with Dr. Weiner in thinking and anticipating that these drugs will be commercially available in the next few months. So, you know, as a brief closure to my statements related to new treatment approaches and clinical trials, we also need to remember that all of us should continue to work together to also improve the system. We want all of patients to know that there are a lot of clinical trials available for consideration. The patients should discuss the possibility of participating in some of the clinical trials with their physicians. Additionally, it's important to think that all of the standards of care today are available because clinical trials were done in the past to find better treatments. And with your help and the help of really all of us in the field, I am certain that by involvement of all of us in the clinical trial systems, we will have better standards of care in the next few years. So, Caroline, I'm going to close here to give the opportunity for other speakers. And as Eric said, I'll be very happy to take any questions later on.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Perez. It's just a wonderful presentation, and also just for inspiration in terms of just all the work that's being done in the oncology, in the breast cancer field, and in research that offers such really hope and promise for everybody on the call. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you, too, during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Larissa Corday. Dr. Corday is Assistant Professor, University of Washington School of Medicine. Division of Medical Oncology. She's assistant member of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center Public Health Sciences Division. So she, too, wears many hats. And Dr. Corday is going to address managing side effects and pain and quality of life concerns. I now turn the program over to Dr. Corday.
Thanks, Carolyn, for that introduction and for inviting me to speak on this call today. And I think as Dr. Weiner and Dr. Perez have already very eloquently outlined, with advances in the treatment of breast cancer, we have an increasing number of breast cancer survivors. And so what then becomes an issue is to think a little bit about side effects of treatment, how these affect quality of life, and how to deal with some of these side effects. And so that's really going to be my job today, is to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to briefly touch today on three topics. The first is management of side effects from hormonal therapy, and specifically on managing hot flashes. I'm going to talk also about strategies for coping for muscle and joint pain related to treatment with aromatase inhibitors. And finally, I'm going to close with talking a little bit about management of bone health in women with a history of breast cancer. So for the first topic, hot flashes are a very common side effect of a number of cancer therapies, affecting up to about 65% of women with breast cancer. While these certainly aren't a life-threatening side effect, they can certainly have significant effects on quality of life. Treatment with tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors can lead to hot flashes in women who've never had them before, or more commonly, for those women who have already experienced menopause and some of the symptoms that go along with it, they can lead to both an increase in the frequency and in the severity of hot flashes. So I'm going to touch today both on pharmacologic or medicine treatments for hot flashes, things that can be prescribed to reduce their frequency or intensity, and also on lifestyle factors that can potentially help. So as a first step, I think it's important to first try to identify triggers for hot flashes. For example, certain foods or drinks, potentially caffeine or alcohol, that might trigger hot flashes. And one way to do this is to keep a hot flash diary, which is something that I do recommend to my patients, hopefully to be able to try to figure out what types of things are associated with hot flashes that could potentially be avoided. A lot of people complain also of nighttime symptoms, and if those are a problem, some women have had success with changing the time of day that they take their medicine, potentially with sleeping in a cooler room or using a fan at night. And for that matter, even for daytime symptoms, using a fan in the room that you're in can also be helpful. Dressing in layers can be helpful, and as I said, identifying dietary triggers that should be avoided is also a good sort of lifestyle technique and can be used. Exercise has been shown in a number of studies to be helpful in breast cancer survivors for a number of things, including fatigue, management of overall quality of life and psychological symptoms. And there have been some studies on whether they can be specifically helpful for what we refer to as vasomotor symptoms, specifically hot flashes, which are thought to relate to vascular and nerve changes from estrogen deprivation. Whether exercise can actually physically make a difference in these vasomotor symptoms has been studied, but not well studied. But it is definitely something that can be beneficial overall for quality of life, and therefore I do recommend that. There is some data suggesting specifically that yoga might be helpful for hot flashes, and so that's something that I think is very important in terms of future study. So if lifestyle modification isn't enough, which often can help but not completely abate hot flashes, then medical management is something that can be considered. In terms of medicines that can be used to treat or prevent hot flashes, one of the most well-studied treatments are the newer types of antidepressant medicines known as SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs, selective norepinephrine and serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are two more recent classes of antidepressant medicines. Perhaps the most prescribed medicine for hot flashes is a medicine called venlafaxine, also known as Effexor. It's best to start at a very low dose and then slowly increase the dose if the treatment is not effective. It's important to note that several weeks can go by before an initial effect is seen, so it's really important to give the medications a chance to work before trying to switch to a different treatment. A word of caution, some of the other medicines in this class, things like Paxil, have also been studied, but there is some emerging data suggesting that some of these drugs, not specifically Effexor, but some of the other ones, may have an important interaction with tamoxifen, which might actually decrease the effectiveness of tamoxifen. So it's really important to discuss with your own medical oncologist, based on what other treatments you're on, which medication might be best for management of hot flashes in your individual case. Other drugs that are sometimes prescribed for hot flashes include medications called Neurontin, also known as gabapentin, something called clonidine, which is an older medicine used for the treatment of high blood pressure, and this is available actually both in a pill form and as a patch. A lot of women are also interested in complementary or alternative medical treatments for hot flashes. Acupuncture is something that's been looked at in a number of small studies, and data from these studies suggest that it might be effective. Other mind-body approaches such as yoga and hypnosis have been looked at in small single-institution studies as well. In terms of supplements, things like soy and black cohosh get asked about a lot, and I have a couple of concerns with these. One is that there's actually very little data on whether they're effective, and the second is that these supplements may actually have some estrogenic properties, and so there's at least a theoretical concern that in women with hormone receptor-positive disease that these could actually contribute to a risk of recurrence, and so I think that caution needs to be used in thinking about these medicines. One of the other ones that has been looked at, one of the other supplements that has been looked at is vitamin E, and that's something that, again, in studies has not been definitively proven to be better than just a placebo, meaning a sugar pill, a non-active ingredient, in terms of controlling hot flashes. But I think at least with vitamin E, we can say that there's not data suggesting it might be harmful, so at least that's a safer alternative. The second issue I wanted to discuss is pain, and particularly muscle and joint pain that's often related to use of aromatase inhibitors. Overall, about 30% of women using AIs, aromatase inhibitors, will have some muscle or joint symptoms, and often this is manifested as an increase in some pre-existing symptoms, often related to arthritis. In terms of who's more likely to get these type of symptoms, they appear to be associated with obesity, with previous treatment with chemotherapy, and potentially with time since menopause, with women who have undergone menopause more recently prior to their diagnosis of breast cancer being more likely to have some of these joint or muscle-related symptoms than those who are further out from the time of their menopause. There also appears to be a slight increase in the risk of carpal tunnel syndrome among women taking aromatase inhibitors. Thankfully, only about 5% of women who use aromatase inhibitors have symptoms that are severe enough or debilitating enough that they would need to stop their treatment. One common question people ask is whether this is what we would think of as a class effect, meaning does it happen with all aromatase inhibitors? Can we see that it's worse with one aromatase inhibitor versus another? Can we try changing aromatase inhibitors in the face of symptoms of hot flashes? I think right now we don't have any particular data suggesting that one of the AIs is a worse offender than the others. And some of the upcoming studies in which aromatase inhibitors are being compared head-to-head will hopefully give us additional data about this question. In terms of treatment, I think the first step is really symptomatic management, meaning using things like NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, such as ibuprofen or Aleve, or Tylenol. Of course, being careful not to recommend not to exceed the recommended doses of these medicines. Something else that's been looked at in this regard is vitamin D, and that appears to show some promise in some initial studies of potentially alleviating painful symptoms associated with aromatase inhibitor therapy. If symptoms are unmanageable, and particularly if they're affecting somebody's ability to engage in their normal level of activity, one option is a drug holiday. And the reason why this is important, a drug holiday means basically stopping the medicine for a short period of time. The reason why that's important is to see if the symptoms are actually being caused by the AI or if they're just kind of a co-offender, meaning happening at the same time but not caused by that medicine. And this is important because there are a lot of other things going on around the time of a breast cancer diagnosis and initiation of new treatments that might also be affecting joint symptoms. For example, sometimes after effects of chemotherapy can linger or after effects of radiation, including fatigue, might be contributing. In some cases, women who were previously very active decrease their level of physical activity after a diagnosis of breast cancer for various reasons, or they may have to significantly alter their normal routines, both as a result of physical and emotional effects of a cancer diagnosis, or for recovery from surgery, or due to other treatments that have been initiated. So if a drug holiday is initiated and the symptoms are clearly related to the aromatase inhibitor, then potentially some other management strategies might be helpful. One option that I alluded to earlier is switching from one AI to another. Sometimes women will have symptoms on one treatment but not on another treatment. And in about 30% of cases, it appears, switching from one AI to another may actually be effective. In patients where switching an AI is not an effective treatment, where they continue to have severe symptoms, switching to tamoxifen might be another option. One other potential therapy, one quick aside, there's been one very small but very nicely designed study looking at acupuncture for treatment of AI-induced joint pain, which suggests that this might be helpful in terms of dealing with these symptoms as well. So I think as time goes on and as we learn more about these medications and how they might be causing these side effects, we may come up with some more effective management strategies, but I think at least what I've presented is hopefully a start. So the last issue I'll address today is bone health, which, again, as survival for breast cancer improves, there are more and more women out there with a previous diagnosis of breast cancer and on treatments that can potentially affect the bones, and so this is really becoming an increasingly important issue. A number of important and very effective breast cancer treatments have the unwanted side effect of decreasing bone densities. The aromatase inhibitors as a class appear to have some effect on bone density, and in addition, chemotherapy in young women can cause early menopause, leading to more rapid decline in bone density. And this is important because bone density is associated with an increased risk of fragility factor, primarily fractures of the spine or the hip, which can be a real issue in older postmenopausal women. Women with severe osteoporosis, meaning very, very low bone density, can have up to a tenfold higher risk of fragility fracture compared to those with normal density. When I'm planning to start treatment with a medicine that could affect bone density, I generally recommend a baseline bone density scan called a DEXA scan to assess risk of fracture. And in women who already have osteoporosis at the time of their diagnosis, particularly in those with other risk factors for fracture, such as a family history of having bone fractures or a personal history of balance problems or frequent falls, I might favor actually the use of tamoxifen over an aromatase inhibitor at the beginning, or sometimes start with the tamoxifen and then eventually after a few years switch to an aromatase inhibitor in postmenopausal women. And in premenopausal women, of course, tamoxifen is usually the standard of care. In women who have normal bone density or osteopenia, it's really important to monitor bone density, and all women at risk for osteoporosis, whether they have a diagnosis of breast cancer or not, should take vitamin D and calcium supplements, engage in regular weight-bearing exercise, and avoid smoking as potential means to decrease their risks of osteoporosis. There's now a fair amount of data that the use of bisphosphonates, medicines such as Actonel, also called Resendronate, Clodronate, also called Bonefos, Ibandronate, also called Boniva, that these drugs may be effective for what we refer to as cancer therapy-induced bone loss. Additionally, intravenous bisphosphonate, such as zoledronic acid, has also been shown to be effective in both treatment and prevention of bone loss associated with cancer treatments. Zoledronic acid has actually been approved for the treatment of osteoporosis in non-cancer patients. You may have heard of it advertised under the trade name Reclast, but it's important to note that the scheduling and dosing is slightly different from what we recommend in patients with bone loss associated with breast cancer. And so, again, it's best to discuss this with your oncologist if that's a possible treatment for you. A few years ago, there was a lot of press about a particular side effect of these medicines called osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is most often seen in people on higher doses of bisphosphonates, those being treated for recurrent or metastatic cancer, and those with pre-existing bone problems. Thankfully, this appears to be relatively rare with the lower doses used in bone health. And the last thing I just want to mention is that there are some fairly promising emerging data that these medicines, bisphosphonates, might actually have a direct anti-tumor effect or might affect bones in a way that could decrease the ability of cancer cells to lie dormant or eventually to spread, and that could result in a decrease in the risk of cancer recurrence. So this is really exciting. I think at this point there is, as I said, some promising data. It's probably too early to make a definitive recommendation for use of these medicines to reduce the risk of cancer recurrence, but I think this is an exciting field of study. There are a number of clinical trials that have recently completed accrual that I think will report results in the next year or so that will hopefully provide more information on this very important question. So with that, I'll close, and I believe Carolyn will now open up the session to questions, and I'm happy to take questions in addition to the other speakers. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Corday. That was really excellent, and really you addressed the really significant side effects that are quite troublesome to the breast cancer community, and so I really appreciate the detail and the information you've provided to everyone, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have lots of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Mary to explain to all of you how to queue up and ask questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, this is a large call, so that means we may not get to everyone's question, and if that happens, please call Cancer Care at 1-800-800-800. 813-HOPE, and our staff are here, our 60 MSW oncology social workers are here to take your questions if you don't get to ask them during the call. So I'm going to ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin. And also please bring all of our speakers, Dr. Weiner, Dr. Perez, and Dr. Corday on board so that they're all here to answer those questions as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Shelley M.
Yes, this question is directed, I think, to Dr. Weiner. First of all, I wanted to thank the entire panel. It's a great discussion. I'm an unusual case because I fall out of the actual criteria for triple negative because I'm negative on everything except slightly positive on the estrogen receptor and 100% basal, like breast cancer, according to the Charles Perreault and Sorley.
And your question, Shelley?
Yes. The question is, because I fall out of that and everything pretty much is always talked about as being triple negative, where are my statistics? Because I'm slightly estrogen positive as far as recurrence and survival statistics on this. I was early stage. I was treated with ACT, Femara, and Herceptin because I was incorrectly diagnosed initially.
Okay, so your question is that you'd like.
The question is survival. How does that differ from triple negative and for reoccurrences?
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Shelley, for that. It's a wonderful question. Now, it is a question that we want you to revisit with your treating healthcare team. I'm going to ask Dr. Weiner to address it in a general way. Obviously, we can't, of course, instruct each of you exactly what you should do in your specific situation. But I wonder if Dr. Weiner could address this in a general way, give us some concepts or knowledge about this particular concern that Shelley has raised.
Yeah. So I don't think we know quite how to think about people who have tumors like yours. And in particular, I mean tumors that generally resemble triple negative cancers but have a small amount of estrogen receptor staining. We don't know that the prognosis is the same or perhaps a little different from a more typical triple negative cancer where the estrogen receptor staining is entirely absent. And for that matter, I don't think we really know how much benefit you can expect from hormonal therapy. From a practical standpoint, I don't think that there's a major treatment controversy because, in fact, the treatment we would consider would be very similar to the treatment for someone who had a triple-negative breast cancer, which would be the use of chemotherapy after surgery. And, you know, if, in fact, one were convinced that there were real estrogen receptor staining, then one would typically add some sort of hormonal therapy, again, perhaps without certainty about how much benefit is being added. The one last thing I can say is that sometimes these situations arise because of poor estrogen receptor testing. And when, in fact, a result like this comes in, oftentimes what we do is we simply retest the estrogen receptors. And I will share with you that, you know, as often as not, that low-level staining turns out to be absent staining when looked at again in more experienced hands, but sometimes it doesn't.
Excellent. Very helpful. Thank you very much. And Shelley, please feel free to call us after the call and talk with your healthcare team, but I hope this has given you some helpful information. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Annette H.
Hello. I'm very appreciative of all the panel's presentations. Thank you. My question concerns the bisphosphonates and something I read recently which caused me to take a holiday from Fosamax, that it could affect the femur. And I guess I'll ask Dr. Corday.
Thank you for that question, Annette. And Dr. Corday, would you address that? In a general way.
Right. So I think what you're referring to is that there is some data suggesting that long-term use of the bisphosphonates could result in a complication called subtrochanteric fracture, where the sort of biologic principle is that with use of bisphosphonates, the bones, although there is an effect on bone turnover, that the bones become more brittle, and that actually could increase the risk of certain types of fractures. And that is something that's been addressed in a couple studies where there looks like there might be an increased risk of that. I wouldn't say that it's something that we think of as a common side effect. I think it's a pretty rare side effect and may slightly be increased with the bisphosphonates. So I think longer-term data on women that have been on bisphosphonates for a long time will help to sort that out.
Thank you. And Annette, we definitely want you to go back to your treating healthcare team as well and take this information to them. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Margie G.
Hi, I have a question about peripheral neuropathy. I work at Gilda's Club, and that's one of the major questions I get from breast cancer survivors dealing with peripheral neuropathy. I guess that would be Dr. Corday.
Yeah, that is a common issue that comes up. Dr. Corday, would you address that in a general way, just some general guidelines that are helpful?
Yeah, so unfortunately, peripheral neuropathy is certainly a side effect of a number of treatments that we use for breast cancer, most specifically some of the taxanes can cause that. I think the most important thing, first of all, is that while you're on treatment, that your doctor is carefully monitoring how this develops, whether it's becoming severe, and addresses that during treatment before it gets to the point where it's where it's irreversible. There are some trials looking at the use of certain sort of supplements, adjuncts. People have looked at B6, glutamine, and other things in terms of how their ability to either prevent or treat peripheral neuropathy. But I think those are studies that are either, I think the data is somewhat inconclusive or still emerging. And I would invite both Dr. Weiner and Dr. Perez to add anything if they know of anything else.
So I don't know of any great treatments for peripheral neuropathy. There, you know, occasionally there's some success with treatments that we try to decrease symptoms. But even there, you know, we don't do very well. And I think this underscores the importance of trying to understand who benefits from chemotherapy and who doesn't. Because all of the drugs that we have some number of side effects. And while sometimes side effects are tolerable if, in fact, there's a big benefit, what we want to do is eliminate unnecessary side effects from people who aren't going to get a benefit from the treatment we administer.
Excellent point. And I just want to say that we have actually – oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Perez.
Yeah, I just want to mention that, you know, related to peripheral neuropathy, one of the very important factors is when patients start feeling some numbness or tingling, that they should discuss this with their physicians as early as possible so that their physicians then can modulate, you know, the dose or frequency of the chemotherapy agents that may be causing the side effect, because that may help prevent you know, worsening of the symptoms.
And I just want to say that we actually have done teleconferences specifically on peripheral neuropathy, and actually we have found on those programs we have used people from pain services and also from rehabilitation medicine, giving very helpful tips. So those actually, we do have them available on telephone replay as well as podcasts on our website, and we will be planning other programs. But that is an issue that comes up a lot. So there are, for those of you who are currently struggling with this, rehabilitation medicine can often offer some helpful tips just in terms of if it's infecting your feet, in terms of your balance and shoes and things that you need to kind of be aware of. And so there are just there are some other disciplines that might be able to be of help to you in navigating this. So it's really important to get that extra help as well.
Caroline, if I can just reiterate the point that Edith made, because, in fact, you know, a lot of times when patients are going through a course of therapy, particularly adjuvant therapy, which is designed to reduce the risk of having a recurrence, the last thing they want to do is confess to their doctors that they're having side effects because they're concerned that they get all of the treatment. The problem with peripheral neuropathy is that if it develops, sometimes it goes away after treatment, but sometimes it doesn't fully go away. And particularly if it's becoming troublesome during treatment, that is often an indication to try to back off on the dose, because the last thing we want is someone to live the next 30 years of their life with numb fingers and toes and trouble walking because of neuropathy.
So that's really an excellent point. So I think that that's just so important that if there's anything troubling you during treatment, you want to be sure to bring those symptoms directly to your physician treating you. Excellent. Okay. Excellent call, boy. These are great questions. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Jacqueline W.
Hello.
Hello, Jacqueline. Yes,
hi. My question is for any of the providers. In trying to figure out what's the best course of treatment for an ER-positive and PR-positive breast cancer, how valuable is the DX oncogene situation for that? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Perez, do you want to address that question?
If the person is referring to the Oncotype DX gene profile, but probably that, because this is a gene profile that has received approval by several societies, if I may say, in the United States and some other parts of the world to help predict the outcome of patients who are treated with tamoxifen in the setting of having tumor, early breast cancers that are estrogen receptor positive. So it refers actually to a conglomerate of genes. So, the test actually has 21 genes. There are 5 reference genes and 16, other genes that may be associated with cancer growth. And this test is pretty good. It's not that it's 100% perfect for each person in predicting exactly what will happen. But this test essentially approaches the general area of aggressiveness of the breast cancer. So essentially, the more aggressive a cancer is, the least the tamoxifen can be effective as single therapy. So for those patients with what we call a high oncotype DX score, chemotherapy in combination with anti-estrogens may be the optimal approach. So one of the questions that we are trying to figure out right now is how to best use this test in the context of day-to-day patient care. So we ordered this test in many patients, not all patients, with early estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. And again, one of the very important trials being done is called the Taylor X trial to help us further optimize the understanding of the utilization of this test.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lynn F.
Great program. Thank you so much. Two quick questions. You didn't mention anything about the use of the CYP2D6 to determine if a patient metabolizes tamoxifen prior to prescribing it. Wondered what your opinion is on that. And secondly, the use of aromatase inhibitors beyond 5 years in stage 2, stage 3 disease. I can think of several inflammatory breast cancer / advanced cases. They're at that 5-year mark. Should they stay on it indefinitely?
Mm-hmm. So thank you, Lynn. Nice to have you on the call. Dr. Weiner, yes.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry to jump in.
So
in terms of CYP2D6 or CYP2D6, this is an enzyme that is thought to be involved in the conversion of tamoxifen to one of its metabolites, endoxifene. And there is some suggestion that the production of endoxifene is important. And so in patients who do not metabolize tamoxifen adequately because of an alteration in the gene that controls CYP2D6, that as a result of inadequate metabolism, they might not do as well with tamoxifen. The truth is that this is a great theory. It's very appealing to many of us. It appeals to us for many different reasons, including the fact that it's a potential variation from person to person that says that it's not just about the tumor, but it may be about the patient, and that different people react to drugs in different ways. Having said all of that, I don't think at this point in time we are ready to do testing of CYP2D6 before prescribing tamoxifen. And most of the guideline panels have come out in favor of holding off on any testing like this. The clinical trial results, which are all retrospective, have been highly variable, and I think this is a way of introducing a lot of confusion into one's clinical practice by starting to do testing. Now, others may disagree, but I think that this is an area where we have to be pretty careful. In terms of aromatase inhibitors after 5 years, we know that 5 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy, whether it's given as the initial therapy or whether it's given after a course of tamoxifen, is safe and is effective. We actually don't know that continuing that therapy beyond 5 years is more effective than giving it for 5 years, and we truly don't know that it's safe, although I think for many patients it probably is. And in my practice, I stop aromatase inhibitor therapy outside of a clinical trial at that 5-year point. If I have a patient who's feeling particularly hesitant about doing it, sometimes I give it for an extra 6 months and then wean her off it after a brief period of time, but I don't continue this indefinitely.
Excellent.
So
Thank you.
I could just add to what Eric said regarding the CYP2D6 story, the one piece that I completely agree with his explanation and the fact that, or the opinion that it's not ready for prime time currently. The other thing that I alluded to in my presentation was that there are some medications that appear to be CYP2D6 inhibitors, and that in combination with tamoxifen, those could potentially decrease circulating levels of endoxifen. And so I think in terms of choosing other medications while you're on tamoxifen, it's probably reasonable to be thinking about using ones that we know are not CYP2D6 inhibitors versus picking a medicine that is a CYP2D6 inhibitor. And so that's another way that that piece of information might be useful. But in terms of genotyping people for what their level of metabolism is or what their enzyme makeup is, I think that we're early on in that evolution.
I agree completely, and I felt like I was being long-winded already, or else I would have said it. So you're totally right, and I'm glad you brought it up. Thanks.
Well, thank you. This has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank our speakers. They have been just extraordinary. This has been one of the most amazing calls, I have to say. I want to thank all of you who queued up and asked questions, because your questions really help our speakers elaborate on further points. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. Now, I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education program, and that we recognize that in planning such a program that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I do want to just remind you all before we close the program today that although the program is ending very soon, that the help and services that you can get from Cancer Care for Free, those are endless and continue way after this program ends and as long as you need them. Now, Cancer Care offers free support services to people living with cancer. I mentioned earlier we have 60 MSW oncology social workers. We provide individual counseling. We offer support groups on the telephone online. And we also offer practical and financial assistance. And we have lots of materials, booklets, and, of course, these Connect workshops as well. So most importantly, as we conclude our program, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with breast cancer, in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're now part of a community of support and that you can contact Cancer Care at any time for our assistance and help, calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org, and that's in all your materials. And in addition to Cancer Care, there's a whole cohort of organizations that we've listed as well in your materials that you can contact as well. So I want to thank you all for participating in this extraordinary program. I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for being on this call.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.